RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in, everybody. It is Thursday, July 11th, as we're moseying through this summer. It's getting closer and closer towards, media days next week. If you're into that, I am not. I don't pay attention to that, but I understand that it is kind of a coming out of the summer and thinking ahead to the fall for most fans. For those of us that work in football, football is never a downtime. But that is coming up. Like, training camps are right around the corner as well. So we are every day involved in football at LandryFootball.com and every Tuesday and Thursday here on the Landry Football Podcast. The aforementioned LandryFootball.com got our notebooks every day, NFL notebooks, college football notebooks, telling you what's going on. And as we talk to people around the league, as things are happening, news and notes and nuggets and film room nuggets, we're providing that for you. Same thing on the college football end. And working on a lot of features, a lot of posts, grading NFL depth charts as they head into training camp, grading college football rosters, breaking down each conferences. As, again, these media days are coming up, we're going to tell you about the best players and tons of podcasts that we're involved in, we're excited about, including this one. This is our favorite, where we get to talk about, do this one solo. And so I get to talk about things that maybe are not as good a fit when you have a co-host. Talk a little bit more X's and O's. And by the way, we are picking it up. We have hope you've enjoyed our series, gotten good feedback. Hope you're liking it, learning something. We got into the receivers. Of course, if you haven't listened, we've taken you through evaluating the quarterback position. How do you play it? What are their responsibilities? Putting together a game plan. We've done for running backs. We're on to receivers. We started that on Tuesday, and we will get through it today. We've got a couple of questions that people sent in, so we're going to get right on to that in just a little bit. And then, of course, we'll take any questions on that subject or any others that you might have. Just send an info to contact Chris on the website. If you want to send me on Twitter, it's at Landry Football. We can address it either way right there. So please do so if you would like something to be addressed. I want to get to a couple of questions before we get to breaking down receivers. I did want to spend a couple of moments to talk about something you may have heard about yesterday. It was in our notebook, the NFL notebook. But a former player that I am very familiar with, University of Tennessee, ex-Vol Albert Haynesworth, with the Titans, with the Redskins, is struggling right now. He's in need of a kidney transplant donor, and he suffered a brain aneurysm a few years back. He's just 38 years old. We lost Jarrett Lorenzen last week, former Kentucky player, New York Giants backup, and now we're dealing with a different situation. You know, Albert has gone ahead and put his phone number out there. And look, this is serious stuff, folks. We certainly, our thoughts and prayers are out with him. And if there's any way out there you can help or forward it to people, that would be great. That's when someone is looking for that type of help and someone is in a position to do something and they wish to do it, we certainly want to be involved in any way we can. So Godspeed to him. And the rest of the news is immaterial. It's on the LandryFootball.com in our notebook. So make sure you take advantage of, you know, little news and nuggets that are less important, of course, if they're football related. But we wanted to at least talk about Albert. Albert had a troubled career, got into a lot of issues on the field and controlling his emotions. Guys, you had that in Knoxville, excuse me, but we certainly are behind him 1,000% in his fight, and wish him nothing but best in our thoughts and prayers. Let's answer a couple questions before we get into more discussions about receivers, and answer a couple questions with regard to the receiver position. Okay, one is a follow-up question that Kevin had. Kevin is very, very bright questioner and has about three of them here. One, he says, from what I understand, Chris, you believe that reform is needed for the NCAA transfer portal. What is the common reason players enter the portal? Do they feel they were misled during the recruiting process, upset about not being a starter, coaches nudging players to transfer, or something else? Should there be different remedies based upon the reasons of the transfer? Shouldn't the NCAA consider stripping scholarships from programs who are found to have compelled kids to transfer? All good questions and kind of points there. So let me just take them one by one. What is the common reason players enter the portal? Everybody has their own story, but the majority is this. They're leaving because they are not getting the playing time they had hoped. Understand, Kevin, in the recruiting process, you like players, you talk about where you see they fit, and quite frankly, you spend all the recruiting process telling them how great they are. Then they come on campus, I think there's, on the player side, a sense of entitlement that, well, this guy's going to be a real, you know, you don't promise people starting jobs. You know, you may tell them, hey, you're going to start here, you're the best guy. You come in, and then they're not. Maybe they've been misevaluated. Maybe they just don't work hard enough, and there are guys just as good or better and work harder. And so instead of in the old days where you stuck it out, you worked harder, you got better, you want to go somewhere else. Maybe find, you know, because you had 8 or 10 different schools that recruited you, 3 or 4 at least, that told you how good you are. Maybe you're going to give one of them a chance. You know, in essence, I think that's, in large part, what happens. Now, there are also cases where the guy is not as good as you thought. And so, I mean, obviously, if they're not getting the playing time, they're leaving, as I just mentioned. But in many cases, a lot of those guys, a lot of the schools are not all that unhappy that the player's leaving, because they got other guys they've recruited since that are better. So it's a blessing in that you could take that scholarship and turn it around and use it again to recruit somebody else that, you know, maybe you get a better fit for you. So, look, you bring up some good points. Are player teams nudging players to transfer? I think there are. I don't think there's any doubt about it. You bring up something that is viable. If a school is kind of forcing a kid out, nudging him out, this is where the fine line, forcing, nudging, that's playing with words a little bit, then yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you need to look at it and say you are committed. Scholarships, we need to know, first of all, they're not guaranteed. They're not four-year scholarships. Okay, it's a renewable one-year scholarship. So there's no guarantee. So that would require maybe more of a commitment, changing of the rules where it's not a year-to-year renewal, that if certain stipulations are met academically and then obviously socially, character-wise, there needs to be more commitment by the school. Because what if the kid wants to stay? What if he's in a program at your school academically that he really wants to get a degree from your school better than transfer somewhere else? I think he does deserve the right. You offered him the scholarship. If you misevaluated him, that's on you. Now, I do believe a player needs the backing at that point. I think that if a player comes in, he doesn't work real hard. Maybe he does all the other things, but he doesn't work real hard. Well, is he earned the right to get his scholarship renewed every year? I don't think so. If he hasn't done what he's supposed to do, he doesn't work hard, he's entitled, whatever. No, I don't think it should be guaranteed a spot. And I don't think that should be held against the school. Well, how do you really prove what happened? I mean, it's a lot of he said, she said, and, you know, I get a lot of that. Player thinks he's working hard. He's really not. I've been in that boat. So the difficulty is, the most common reason, it falls into those two things I just mentioned. You ask, do you feel they were misled during the recruiting process? No, I don't think they're misled. I think kids are told that they're good. They are good. And you got a real chance. I don't, it doesn't happen that you're promised this or that. I don't, that doesn't, that such is such a false narrative there. That's, that does it happen? Sure. Is it happen a lot? No. Are they upset about not being a starter? Bingo. Yes. They're upset about not starting, being the key guy. And again, I think coaches do nudge players. Listen, if it is found that a coach nudges a player out and the kid's doing everything, then yeah, I'm in agreement there should be repercussions. But there again, you always are on that fine line. Did he work hard enough? Is it, all those things are fair. I'll say this, and I don't know how many people are aware of this. I'm a big believer in this. Kid gets injured, you know, you keep him on scholarship. You pay his tuition. So I think there are things that are done. I think in situations like that, I would like to see a player be allowed to stay. If he wants to stay on campus, he wants to be part of the team, he should be allowed. Now, at that point, make the school, you know, put it on the school to say, no, we're not renewing your scholarship. Well, why? I don't know that not working hard enough is going to be enough to justify that. I think that's going to get a school in a negative situation publicly where I don't think they can get away with that. So I think the kid should be allowed to stay if he wants to. But if he wants to play, and this is the other part that I don't think people understand. You think old Kevin is going to be a really good player for you, get him there, and he's just not as good as you thought. And you bring him in and you say, Kevin, look, here's your situation. Here's where we see you here. We love you. And this happens a lot, Kevin. We like you. You know, we think you have a role here, but it's not going to be in the role that we thought and you thought. If you want to go somewhere else, we can make calls. We think you can certainly potentially start at other places, and we can help you navigate through that. If that's something you want to do, you help the young man out a lot. And that happens a lot more than you know and you think. You develop a relationship with these players, and they're a little bit like family, and you want to do right by them. Here's the other thing. Even if you don't believe that they care about players as family, if they don't treat – if you're a recruiter, you're a coach, if you don't treat these players well and you do a disservice to them, you're going to have a hard time going back into that high school ever again where that kid came from, and that word's going to get out. No, I don't think that happens as much as people might think. So, listen, I'm on the side of common sense. Help the kid. If he wants to move, help him get a landing spot that's best for him. If he just leaves on his own and he hasn't done what you wanted, I mean, here's the other thing about a player, and I'm going to say this to the players out there. For those of you that are listening, I think the players, anybody in your community should know this. If you're a kid and you go to a school and you sign and you're not happy because you're not starting and you're not maybe working as hard, you're not doing the things that you thought, you thought you were better, but you're not, and you're not doing the little things, you go transfer somewhere else, you go to the transfer portal, don't think these coaches don't talk to one another. Yeah, old Joe was, you know, he was lazy. He had a lot of talent. He didn't work hard. Well, guess what? That word gets around on you as a former, you know, like the Woodward former employee. So, look, go to a school, work hard, do everything they tell you to do. And if it doesn't work out and you want to go somewhere else, then you can go in and you know that they're going to say good things about you. They're not going to badmouth you and say he's a bad kid if he's a good kid. Not going to say you're lazy if you did. You know, the kid's learning how to work. I think he really tried his best. He doesn't quite know how it's to pay the price, but he's starting to get there. And he's a good kid. He will work. He'll do what you tell you. And I do think he has a chance to play. It's just that we've got some guys here that are a little bit better. You can get good recommendations. So, listen, I think that there are remedies that are based upon a number of things. But I do believe honoring a player's scholarship is important. You can put them on an athletic scholarship, a athletic administration scholarship, pay their medical tuition. I think all those things need to be protected if they have a medical injury. I think if they're at the school and they're just not good enough, but they don't want to go somewhere else. They want to be at that school. They love being in that engineering program or what have you. That should be honored. And if you come to the conclusion that you need the scholarship for your team, you have to talk to the kid, and he has to decide, look, I'll continue to play football on the team or I won't. But he still gets the scholarship as if he's on the team. I think that's fair in that case. That kid deserves that. The kid that doesn't work hard, gets into trouble, doesn't do what he's supposed to do, doesn't want to work, is entitled. I don't think those kids are entitled to anything. I think they're creating their own problems. Follow-up question Kevin asked, with respect to RPOs, I'm trying to narrow down why illegal man downfield is being overlooked. From the way I understand it, in the college game, a lineman can't be 3 yards downfield before the ball is thrown. Correct. So technically, if a run block is initiated within 3 yards of the line of scrimmage, an offensive lineman can keep blocking his man past the three-yard mark. But once the defender is free of the block, the offensive lineman can't proceed to block or block anymore if he's 3 yards more down the field or until the ball's has been caught. Yes, correct. Officials have to simultaneously evaluate if there is holding, other forms of illegal blocking, how far downfield the lineman is, and know exactly when the ball has been thrown and caught. That's correct. Without the accompaniment of replay on every RPO play or additional officials, doesn't illegal man downfield or RPO just seem destined to continue? Yes, you've nailed it. And you've also nailed why it's being done. It's not easy to catch. And see, basically, pass play and a run play blocking, there are rules regarding that. Where the RPO is a run pass option, which you were alluding to in your question. Very difficult. And they're moving at speed. So timing it up and eyeing it up. It's why I think, you know, the real play replay time system where guys can be just up in the booth that can monitor that replay and buzz it down before the start, that would certainly stop it. But we're not there yet. It's where I think we should be, but it's not there yet. And you've probably heard me talk about that nauseam. I don't want to get off on a tangent on that. It's why we need the help on that. But it's why they're doing it. It's because you can get away with it. It's tough to call. It's just like you teach receivers. You teach defensive backs how to hand fight. You don't grab, but boy, you just kind of lock arms of the other one and keep it down and then separate. They can't notice it, right? Why do you think, you ever notice now, linemen, they tape their hands. You ever notice that? Well, it's usually white tape. It's darn sure going to be, if I'm your offensive line coach, your guys are going to have white tape if you're going up against a team that's wearing a white jersey. White on white's hard to discover. A hand color versus a white jersey, easier to notice, right? It's hard to notice grabbing if you're kind of camouflaging color. You ever notice they've got these different color tapes now? It could be like skin color. It could be black. It could be red. It could be different colors. Notice they're putting different colors of tape that's going to kind of be camouflaged in the defensive line. Well, things you can do about that. You can outlaw that. Those are things you can do. But I'm just giving examples of ways to get away with something. Well, this is very easy to get away with. So it is definitely here to stay, and you've nailed it. Kevin also said, I recently watched a dated offensive line seminar by John Lover. No, John. On John for years. He explained some of the pass protections they used for John Elway in the 93-94 season. One of the protections that seemed odd was a two-read strong protection where an uncovered center has the Mike assignment if he blitzes or the Sam if he blitzes and the Mike doesn't. Is this type of protection still used in today's NFL? To some degree, I'll get into it in a second. It seems that the center would have to be very athletic to execute this because the Sam assignment could be a slot corner or it coming off the edge. Yeah, you're not going to get that on the edge. So what I think is, in a call like that, you've got the Mike if he blitzes or if the Sam if he blitzes in the A or B gap. But if the Sam goes on the outside, the Mike's not reaching the guy there. That has to be picked up, and that has to be read by the back. And so that has to be communicated. So that's the call. You're correct. The call is right. But, you know, the Sam backer could come inside. And he's got him if he comes inside. He's got the mic if he comes inside. But even if the mic goes outside, somebody else has got to pick him up. In a lot of even fronts, well, the center's uncovered. It's why centers have to be very athletic. Two things. They have to be able to get out onto the second level a little bit quicker, and they have to be able to adjust. They have to be able to, you know, what we call reach out and get down and help out on a tackle or reach out on a backer. But no, if a guy is screaming and blitzing off, he's going one way. Now, you can reach the Sam backer if it's a delayed blitz, but you can't get a guy coming from the outside. That has to be communicated. So, yeah, the protection in itself – not that one specifically, but the protection itself are very similar. That's why the most difficult part, Kevin and everyone, is for a young lineman and for young quarterbacks and young backs, the biggest difference in protections is identifying it. In other words, in college ball, you know, you ever hear that if you hear the sound, the audible sounds of quarterbacks, they'll say, 52 is the mic, 52 is the mic. You listen to that. You hear that? They're pointing out the mic because that tells you where everybody else, who everybody else is, where they got. But in the NFL, the Sam backer might be the mic on a given play. And it completely confuses everybody because, again, when you're identifying the mic, you're not, you know, identifying it for identifiable purposes. You're identifying, he's the mic, therefore this guy's the Sam, this guy's the Will, and so now you know who you have to block. Tight end, back, that identifies who you got. Okay, so if you say he's the mic, then you immediately know where the Sam and Will are, and you're able to get your assignment accordingly. So that's why you identify. But if you falsely identify the guy, sometimes you get that the back just goes the wrong way in protection. Tight end, sometimes it's identified wrong. So that's getting a little bit off your question. But no, this is a – there's similar protections, but no, you're 100% right. You're not going out at the center and going to cut off a Sam backer that's coming on the seven gap outside the tight end. That's not physically possible. So you got to pick that up. That's coming. That's the tight end's responsibility. That's the back's responsibility. And your protections, it depends on it. So really good questions there, Kevin. Jacob asks, what do you think was the biggest reason for Amari Cooper's breakout season in Dallas? Better quarterback play? No. Better coaching? No. Different coaching. Amari Cooper was successful in Oakland. He's very productive early. Had some injuries. Had some issues early looking the ball in. No, he's pretty good. He's pretty good. The biggest reason was, for whatever reason, John Gruden didn't like him, and that led to this problem. He could have been every bit as successful in Oakland. He wasn't. And it's, you've got to be all in. I think Dallas's offensive line is good. I thought they used him well. I think they deserve a lot of credit for coaching him and working with him. So I think you could say, you know, better coaching, maybe that. Certainly a better plan for him, but he's been healthy and I think been good pretty much wherever he's been. Thomas asks in some really nice comments. Thank you, Thomas, for listening to this podcast and the others. He had a question. Why are knee braces for offensive linemen so widely used in college, hardly ever used in the pros? They're forced to use them in college a lot more. In the NFL, not forced to use them. They should mandate them. They don't use them in the NFL because they feel it hinders their ability, and they don't want to hinder their ability. You know, they fear it may reduce their effectiveness, and they don't feel they can afford the lack of productivity. I think if everybody used them, it would be better and it would be safer. But that's why they're not used. They're not forced to use. In college, you have a little bit more control. You tell them you need to use them, and guys are more willing to kind of protect themselves there. They're not as risky with that. I mean, the scholarship's important, but you're going, and we just had a nice conversation about that. But, you know, the pro game is a business. And that's the reason they feel it hurts them. All right, let's get into taking some time there, quite a bit of time. I want to get into as much as we can about receivers, hopefully finish up what I want to talk about. And first thing is about reading coverages. So much is made of a quarterback's ability to read defensive coverages, rather. But it's equally important for a receiver to do the same thing. What good is it for a quarterback to recognize where the opportunities to attack the defense are if the receiver, the guy he's throwing the ball to, doesn't see it the same way? We call it get on the same page, but you know, whatever you want to call it, you got to see it the same way. You got to know. It used to be that receivers simply ran the routes they were assigned. You know, I know like in the Norv Turner, Jimmy Johnson, Dallas Cowboy days when Norv ran the offense, for example, and you heard this when we called out the routes. You will be familiar with this if you've listened to this podcast recently. They would call out a 408 route, which was what? It's a four route. You know what a four route is. Okay, four routes, an in route. It's on the passing tree. The X receiver runs that. Okay, a zero route for the tight end, the Y, and an eight route for the Z. XYZ, 408. X runs the 4, Y runs the 0, 8 runs the Z, okay? So Irvin ran the 15-yard in, Novacek ran the shallow cross, and Harper ran the pulse. Troy Aikman went through his progressions, identified what route had the best chance of beating the coverage. He recognized the defense that was in, everyone had the best chance to beat the coverage. The next play would be an 804. Irvin ran the pulse, Novacek ran the shallow cross, and Harper ran the in. Bottom line, the players ran the play that was drawn up and called in the huddle. While that type of approach eliminates a lot of confusion, and that's why they did it. They didn't want Michael Irvin thinking about what route he needed to run. It was enough for him to understand that the four route, you know, he was the first number, so he was the X, and they ran him at X all the time. So when he heard the first number, he knew enough to know what a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 routes were. So he just listened to that first number. He knew what he was running, and he ran it. And if it was the read took Aikman there, then it went there. And it does eliminate a lot of confusion, and that's great. Okay, people say, why didn't everybody do that, Chris? It's great. It's simple. Well, it's a good reason to run it. Here's the downside to it. There's always downsides and upsides, folks. The downside is that the opportunities to take advantage of the vulnerabilities presented by the defense in the last second were missed. Okay, so offense has evolved to the point where receivers have options for the routes that they run. Okay, this requires more communication, more reads by the receiver. So the principles are the same. Okay, let's take the same thing. A 408 today still calls for the X receiver to run the 4 route, the Y to run the 0, the 8 to run for the Z receiver, but it gives him options based on the coverage that he and the quarterback can identify at the line of scrimmage. So he could run the X receiver could run a 15-yard in, a stop, a quick slant, or take off route, depending on what he determined was the best option to beat that particular coverage. And every coverage has vulnerabilities in it. So the receiver, when you hear the side adjustments, that's what we're talking about. He will change the route based upon the coverage. That is a better way to take advantage of how the defense does to you, what the defense does to you. But in order to do that, your quarterback better be able to see it, and your receiver better be able to see it, and they better be able to see it together. Or else if one thinking is thinking one way and one thinking the other, doesn't work. So there are three basic coverages every defense will utilize. Each is designed to take away certain routes, and each leaves the defense vulnerable to other routes. So like you often soft coverage. When cornerbacks are backpedaling on the snap, receivers will convert the deep routes into out routes. So the tight end will split the safeties and attempt to draw the middle linebacker towards him. The slot receiver can run a pivot route. The running back is free to release if there's no blitz. Then that's against off and soft coverage. Okay, running out. They're playing off, running out. Now you say you're going to run it against off and inside coverage. So it's throwing the out route against this coverage is really good, but not enough guys have the arm talent to do it as effectively. But if you have the arm talent, love throwing the out route against off and inside coverage. Okay. So that's something you look at. So you make those examples of making adjustments there is you've got to adjust. Off and soft means a corner is going to be dropping back, possibly in a cover three zone, which is three defensive backs each covering one third deep of the field, which creates opportunities for routes to open up underneath. Off and inside, again, is soft man-to-man. It'll take away the quick inside routes, like the slant that Jerry Rice ran all the way to the Hall of Fame. But it's vulnerable to quick outs, which are tougher for the quarterback to complete. I still like doing that defensively because make it tougher for the quarterback. You're going to take away something, take away the easy route for the quarterback. Make him throw the difficult route. Press is classic man-to-man defense, okay? Cornerback's going to line up inside, force the receiver to release outside, then turn and run with his man with inside position. A derivation of the press coverage is press fail, which means the cornerback lines up as though he's going to press, but before the snap, he shuffles out. Before the snap, the receiver looks for clues in the alignment of the corner. Cornerback's trying not to tip his hand, so he may be baiting the receiver and the quarterback into thinking he's playing one coverage when he's really in another. Good corners don't just cover, but they make press and press bail look the same to confuse the quarterback and the receiver and maybe get them off-guessing is what they're going to do and what's the best route to run. It's on the post-snap read that the receiver gets a true indicator of what the defensive back is going to do. If the corner lines up 7 to 8 yards off the line of scrimmage and is aligned with the receiver's outside shoulder, it might look like he's an off and soft of the receiver. But the receiver can't be sure until after the snap when he sees the cornerback backpedal and reveal his deep covered principles. The receiver then immediately must decide whether he's going to run a post, a deep curl, or something in front of the deep coverage. That decision will also depend on another factor. The drop his quarterback will be taking, something the receiver must always be aware of. If the play is called for a three-step drop, the receiver knows he must choose a short pattern, a slant, a fade, or a stop. If the quarterback's in a seven-step drop, the slant's not going to work since the receiver will be crossing the field all the way crossing it before the quarterback's ready to throw. So you've got to coincide those things together. Keep in mind when you're watching the game from the stands or on your couch, the number of steps a quarterback drops is usually half the number of steps the receiver is going to take before the ball is delivered. So if a quarterback is in a seven-step drop, the receiver has 14 steps to work with. He could drive downfield 14 steps, run a skinny post or a stop and go. He could drive for 9 steps, run the next three to the post, then the last two back to the curl. If the quarterback is dropping 3 steps and he reads off and soft, the receiver might run a stop route at 6 steps where he's guaranteed about 10 yards of separation, will have only one man to beat in open state in open space. So many factors dictate what route a receiver will choose to run, but the key remains in the post snap read. A cornerback may lay 9 yards off the receiver before the snap, indicating off and soft coverage. But if he doesn't start backpedaling on the snap, he's sitting on the underneath route. He's hoping to bait the receiver into running. If the receiver doesn't pick up that first post-snap cue, he'll run a stop route. Get hammered as soon as the ball is delivered. The correct decision would be to take the route downfield, blowing past the corner. It's sitting on the underneath route. There's just lots of examples of receivers with poor snap awareness. Plaxico Burress was a really talented receiver, but he probably had more bad reads that put Eli Manning into trouble that you can shake a stick at. The X receiver is the one who has to worry about press coverage. Corners can't commit to pressing the Z or the slot because the guys are lined up off the scrimmage. Pressing an X is designed to keep the bigger, strongest receiver from releasing off the line cleanly. Trying to disrupt the timing and rhythm of the quarterback depends, you know, on disrupting that receiver. Okay, The quarterback is hoping for that receiver, the ball to arrive at the same place at the same time. If you disrupt that, it's a problem. A lot of rookie receivers, you know, come in. Boy, they've got a lot of ability. They're going to be great. They can't get off press coverage. So when the ball's there, they're not. The rhythm is broken. Inside the red zone, the X will almost always feature exclusively press coverage. A classic X guy, they love that. They run the fade against the press corner. They don't worry about the inside position, you know, giving that up. That's not an option. They're going to take that bet. If you're talented enough, you can do that. But here's the other thing. There's nuances to being a good receiver. Even a guy like Randy Moss wasn't just a physical guy, but you ever watch Randy Moss? Go back and watch the fade. Never gave away his eyes or his hands that the ball was coming. I mean, he was really great. Corner had no clue when the ball was coming, and therefore it was defenseless. So when you watch a game, pay attention to the cornerback's alignments with the X receiver. That's what you want to focus on. This will help you predict what route the receiver might choose to run. Then watch the quarterback's drop. The number of steps he'll take will narrow down the route possibilities. When an incompletion occurs because one quarterback throws to one spot and the receiver's in another, you know, at that point you got enough evidence to know who made the mistake. See what the cornerback's alignment is. What's the best route to run against it? What did the receiver run it? Or need to run something else? That'll tell you right there whether you ran the wrong route. People say, well, you can't tell who ran the right route. You don't know who it's supposed to be. Yeah, you can if you know you've got background in coaching it. The people that talk about it can't tell you because they don't know. But you can tell. You can have a good idea. You know, there's communication issues. And you don't know with 100% certainty what's being communicated. So it's not a definite, but pretty obvious. Based on the coverage, what's the best route for the receiver to run? And if he had the freedom to make the change, I mean, the quarterback could be wrong. The receiver could be wrong. If he ran the right route and the quarterback threw it the wrong place, if the route made the most sense with that coverage, then it's the quarterback's fault. If the route did not make sense for that coverage, well, the receiver's fault. The quarterback threw it where the route that would have made the most sense would have been, well, you have your answer. Couple of questions here. A couple of things here. What's the biggest adjustment that a college receiver has to make? I mentioned that it's the release, getting off the line of scrimmage, getting off a big, you know, you don't, some great college receivers never had a chance to think about reading a coverage because they're too busy trying to get out of their stance. It's a different world trying to get off press coverage in college versus the NFL. How important is the receiver's ability to block? It's still very important. But there are a lot of divas. A lot of guys don't like to do it. First, you got to identify who to block. Okay, so guards and tackles know who do they need to block. But receivers have to determine whether the corner, safety, or someone else. And they have to sustain their blocks longer than anyone. They're responsible for the longest blocks in the game. I don't think people realize that. Stalk block, stack block's really important. They got to stay with this man all the way downfield. It's an attitude. It's an effort. You don't get big run plays unless the receiver is blocking well. Doesn't happen. You look at a big run play, I guarantee you there's a receiver that made a good block. Why is the fade route so popular in the red zone? It's the only route that defenses can commit only one defender to covering. Okay. Once an offense establishes a fade route, a lot of other options open up because of it. Say the quarterback throws the fade route to the Z receiver on the tight end side of the field. If the safety commits to the fade, you have the tight end run a seam route. The very next play, the quarterback drops and watches the safety. If he stays at home and covers the tight end, the quarterback throws the fade. If the safety cheats to the outside, he throws the seam to the tight end. It's such a difficult thing to cover in the red zone because you have to commit one way or the other. And if you're smart, you can figure out which way to go. Catching the football. I think we've given you a little bit of an idea of how difficult it is to play receiver. It's not as easy as you think. Got to catch the football. It's something that every receiver position requires. But there's a lot of things that may go into that. This guy's got natural hands you can catch. It's not you can catch, you can't catch. There's a technique to it. You can improve your catching. And this is why when we talk about people's hands, some guys use bad technique. They don't have bad natural hands. Sometimes, in some cases, they do. In some cases, they don't. Got to teach fundamentals. So we're going to get into that. When a receiver readies the ball, and this is something you can teach family members, young kids, really important things, I think, that are important to learn about the technique of catching it. Because their hand size and their natural eye-hand coordination, you know, that's going to come or it's not. But you can improve technique. So when you're ready for the football, you got to extend your hands and your arms and your fingers into a catching position. Okay? Now, when it's rainy, you don't see receivers catch the ball extend as much. They use their bodies as the third point of contact, which helps them maximize control in slick conditions. When the ball makes contact with the hands, always the hands, by the way, a receiver needs to bring it into his body and secure possession. He then works to tuck it in position, same way a running back does. Once it's protected, then he can turn upfield and gain those yards. That's really key. And this is when you're in slick conditions. We're going to start there, wet conditions. If the receiver turns and runs before he's secured possession, it's likely going to be an incompletion. If he turns and runs before he's tucked it away, it's likely a fumble. You want to look at it. Objective eye will look at drops and determine what phase of the process the receiver struggled with. Did he not extend his arms, which allowed the defensive back to knock the ball away? You don't extend your arms. You're trying to get the ball before the defender can knock it away. The closer it's into your body, the better chance he's going to have to knock it away. Well, he's fighting through you or over you. So if you're extending out, you've increased your catch radius, and now he can't. It's a lot tougher to knock the ball away till he gets in front of you, unless he gets in front of you. So did you extend your arms? Did you extend your fingers? Were you sloppy in the tuck? Did you bobble the ball away before you could secure it? Look at it, break it down. It's not just, oh, he fumbled, bad security. Why is it bad security? What did he do wrong? Fix it. There are ways you can fix it. So what I look for is guys that make the tough catch. I look for guys that work on catching the ball outside of the frame with his hands. You better be able to catch off-target throws because there are going to be a lot of them in this league. So I look for catch radius. I'm not worried just about the combine numbers. I want to see on film what's the catch radius. And I want to see guys that can catch the ball. You know, we just had a question about Amari Cooper. Amari Cooper, you could see how good he was because he caught balls out of frame as much as anybody. Jordan Matthews, another good player. You see Hopkins, you know, catch the ball out of frame. Odell Beckham, those things. And here's the other thing. The quarterback has more confidence in the receiver if it can catch the ball out of frame. So if you catch it out of frame, all of a sudden, the quarterback develops confidence in your ability to catch it out of frame. So now, where he would have, in ordinary cases, go to a second progression because the guy's covered. Now he's thinking, wait a minute, I could still throw it where he can catch it. So I'm not throwing it to him. You know, you hear this, throw it in the numbers. You don't throw it in the numbers. You're throwing it outside the shoulder, the back shoulder fade, the back hip fade, the front side, you know, where you're going to go down, reach, dig it out, go up and get it. The defender can't get it there, but my guy can. Well, the confidence that the quarterback sees in his receiver not only doing it time and time again in games but in practice, he knows he can do it. If you do it enough in practice, you know, we can complete this. That's where a guy who's open, not open, is still open. So here's the thing about catching the ball. Teach your youngsters. Teach anybody. Extend your hands out. Extend your fingers out. Catch the ball. Go out and invite the ball in there. And then when you catch it, you want to have the extension because as the ball's force hits you, you naturally bring it into your body. So you want to make your arms and hands bent. Arms, hands, fingers bent. Absorb the ball like a net and bring it in. If I asked you to catch something, if you're going to throw something, you got a better chance of, you know, throwing it against the wall or into a net. Where it's into a net, it's going to absorb the force of the ball coming in. And you're going to catch it. If you let it come into your body, you can't catch it. You're not catching it. What you're doing is you're hoping to trap it. So immediately as it hits your body, you engulf the ball. That's tough to do. And you usually your eye-hand coordination, even with the best, it's not going to work. It's going to bounce out the majority of times because once it hits, whatever, the point of the ball or the side of the ball, it will bounce off in either a straight or a diagonal direction, and you're not going to be able to keep it in. So extend out, bring it in. You don't have to snatch it. Well, the great ones can snatch it with their hands. I get that. But you don't have to be a hand snatcher. But if you absorb the ball, net the ball into your body, now you're cushioning it in. Really important. So there's some things. This final question before we call it a day is, had the spread offense affected the way receivers develop in college? Well, the expansion of the passing game in college has produced more receivers that are used to catching the ball a lot. But those catches often come with the cost. The vast majority of these targets are quick routes. So what they are, they're married to the three-step drops and the roll passes. College receivers don't run routes. You know, they are running routes that are three-step roll routes. Okay, they're not married to running routes off a seven-step drop. They don't run the full route tree. They don't develop any sophistication about the routes they're asked to run. So that's the biggest difference. And remember, the route tree, which we've gone over for you, when I say a guy doesn't run the routes on the route tree, well, they don't because they're running three-step drops. Everything you're running is the quick out, the quick hitch, the slant. You're not running the deeper routes because you can't off a three-step drop. They're just kind of rolling and, you know, maybe run a little curl, come back if it's a rollout. I mean, it's just very, very simplistic. There's you can catch the football. You got ability to run. Maybe you can, you know, catch a fade. You can do things, but you don't run the route tree because you don't run seven-step drops from the quarterback position. So with all the 11 personnel playing in the pros today, there are plenty of jobs for a lot of productive receivers coming out of college, but the jobs these days are that they're able to do when they get to the NFL in many cases is going to be limited by the offensive systems that produce, you know, the level of production that they're able to help you with. But if you're big, you can run. You've got natural hand ability. You will work. Absolutely, you can be taught and taught effectively how to be a receiver in the league. All right, folks, that'll wrap it up for today. We appreciate you joining us. We will, hey, what's next on the X's and O series? Talk about the offensive line, man. It's where it all happens. We're going to get you into that, teach you about the offensive line play, and take you through the next step of football, position by position. We appreciate you joining us on Landry Football Podcast. Please join us at thelandryfootball.com for all the latest information, news, notes, film room breakdowns on landryfootball.com. All year long, got our summer savings special. Take advantage of that now. You don't want to commit $49 for an entire year? That's okay. Try it out for a month. Try it out for 3 months. Great opportunities, great value. So check it out today. You're going to see football in a whole new light. You're going to enjoy football better. Join us next time on another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a Jim Fannin Show Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Now let's talk about three items. I'm going to delve into one of them specifically for you. Here's what we need to be the best that we can be. We need beables, a beable, B-E-A-B-L-E. What's a beable? These are I am statements. I'm awesome. That's a beable. I'm patient. That's a beable. Things that you want to be, you must act like it and be it now. A beable. Well, we'll talk about that in depth maybe in another show. But there's also doables. Well, these are the tasks that will lead to these major goals that's going to take you to the vision for 2019 in every arena of your life, not just your primary business arena. And again, we do have a primary arena in our life. It's a major aspect. It doesn't mean it's the most important, but it's the one we spend inordinate amount of time, energy, and even money. What are your doables? That's your task list to do to reach these goals. But today, I want to talk about the otherable. That's a seeable. S-E-E hyphen A-B-L-E. A seeable. A seeable. That's a major part of your life that you actually see or view on a regular basis. I mean, these are your office desk, your home closet, your garage, your bathroom sink, etc. When your seeables are disorganized, in disarray, or in chaos, it becomes more difficult to accomplish your major vision and goals. Why? Why is that going to be my stumbling block? It's because you're consistently bombarded with the opposite of what helps a champion stay a champion.
The Jim Fannin Show can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.